Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument in the combined causes of State of Texas versus Flag Redford and State of Texas versus Rutherford Oil and others. We're ready to hear from petitioners.
May I please support Mr. Jose Randall will present argument for petitioners. Mr. Randall will reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chanton. Chief Clerk, Mr. Gibson. Mr. Warnick. My name is Jose Morales, representing the General Land Office of the State of Texas and Commissioner Morrow in this matter. The matter has been before this court once before in the Oxy matter, and as a result, I think the court should be fairly familiar with some of the issues that are before it. There are mainly two issues that the court will need to address in this appeal. First, whether Sections 52-135 and 52-137 of the Natural Resources Code allow for the administrative proceeding or the type of administrative proceeding that's before the court today. If it does allow, or if those provisions of the Texas Natural Resources Code do allow for that type of proceeding, then the court will need to address the constitutional arguments that have been made by respondents and that have been discussed by the Austin Court of Appeals in the case that we refer to as Rutherford 1 in our application for writ of error. The basis for the Austin Court of Appeals decision in Rutherford 1 for requiring the Austin District Court to enjoin the land office once again was because they felt that there was a good possibility that this proceeding may be violative of the separation of powers provision in the Texas Constitution, as well as violative of the due process requirements of the Texas Constitution. The Austin Court of Appeals held that Land Commissioner Morrow's authority under the hearing statute is limited to accounting mathematical type errors. The Court of Appeals defined accounting type errors as those that do not involve interpretation of a disputed lease provision. I've set up Section 52-135 over here for the court to see. It's probably very difficult for the court to see it, especially at that distance, so I've provided with each of the justices with copies of some of the documents that I'll be referring to during the argument. There's no mention anywhere in 52-135 that the land commissioner or the audit division over the general land office cannot look at disputed lease provisions. Indeed, it expressly provides that a lessee who has been issued a audit deficiency assessment has a right to request a redetermination hearing and, along with that request, file a statement of grounds, which lists, of course, the legal problems and whatever other legal arguments he may have as far as the land office's assessment being invalid. If this were to be solely on the basis of mathematical and accounting type errors, I would see no reason whatsoever for any lessee to provide legal arguments or to refer to anything that the agency has done that would be illegal. There's only one way that two and two add up, and that's four, and I can't imagine that anyone would be able to raise a legal argument that is improper.
Counsel, your opposition says that you keep changing your position on this question of whether or not Commissioner of the General Land Office has the power to adjudicate and thereby be the judge in his own case. That you told the trial court that the final orders by the commissioner were not really adjudications. Then you conceded an argument before the Court of Appeals that your hearings would amount to adjudication. Then on rehearing before the Court of Appeals, you changed your position again and said you were not attempting to adjudicate, but rather that all you wanted to do was to determine accounting-type errors. Now, before this court, again you say that you have been authorized by the Constitution and the legislature to adjudicate. What is your position today, and what is the state's position?
The state's position has always been that Commissioner Morrow can adjudicate these type things. And this is, even if it is an adjudication, it's clearly authorized by the statute at issue in this case. I will concede that during the time that we spent down in the trial court, we did make the argument that this was really not a judicial determination. It was really something that would allow for the parties to come before the agency and present their disagreements for the agency to listen to those and then at that time decided whether it was going to change the assessment or disregard it totally, or whether Commissioner O'Mara would uphold that. My position is today that there is authority both ways, but I feel that it probably is an adjudication. I think that's a position that we would clearly find plenty of support for, irrespective of whether it was or wasn't. Maybe the reason that we were arguing down at the trial court level that it was an adjudication because of the fact that they could come through directly to the trial court if they chose. The provisions, as you can see over on the left-hand chart over there, specifically provides that if a lessee chooses to, that lessee can go directly to the trial court. If it chooses not to, then it can go through the administrative process.
What if that lessee then have the right of trial de novo at the trial court, or is he bound by the substantial evidence rule as applies to most administrative agencies?
Justice Mazzi, in response to your question, there's a trial de novo review. And he will have that same review, or it will have that same review, irrespective of whether it goes to the administrative process and a final order is issued, or whether it goes directly to the trial court.
Let me follow up with you. And so is that your answer as to why there is not a constitutional separation of powers?
There is no problem with the separation of powers provision in this case. This court itself has issued, has issued a number of opinions in previous cases. There's the Blount case that we cite in our brief. There's the Saeeda 2 case that we cite in our brief. There's the opinion in Grounds versus Tolar, which is an opinion written by Justice Gonzalez, which expressly overruled the prior Beaumont Court of Appeals decision in Briggs, stating that because there was statutory authority for that Board of Education to interpret contracts, that it was all right now, whereas prior to that time, prior to the enactment of the statutes in Briggs, it wasn't. There is a number of arguments that we make in our brief, but the first argument that we address, that we present to the court, is that because these rights that lessees have, Rutherford, Conoco, Ladd, Flag Redfern, because of the rights that they have are pursuant to statutory provisions, Chapter 52 of the Texas Natural Resources Code with respect to PSF lands, permanent school fund lands, Chapter 32 as well with respect to permanent school fund lands, Chapter 34 with respect to prison lands, which is what Rutherford has. Because we have specific statutory provisions which allow lessees to lease these type minerals, state minerals, they are to be controlled by statutory requirements, which is exactly what Sections 52.135 and 52.137 is. One of the arguments that the respondents make in their response to our application for Prevere is that we take the position that the state does not have a common law right to contract. We've never taken that position. We've never said that the state does not have a common law right to contract.
So, before you proceed to respond to their arguments, would you address the issue of Trata Novo? If the opponents choose not to pay the amounts, the several million dollars you say they owe the state, they can't play. They cannot have a Trata Novo. Is that correct?
If they choose not to pay?
That's correct.
They cannot go to the courthouse.
So the only way they can avail themselves of the right to Trata Novo is by paying several million dollars that you claim they owe in order for them to avail themselves of their remedy. Is that correct?
With respect to Rutherford, I believe that the figure is somewhere around $4 million that we're claiming, or that the audit division over at the General Land Office is claiming that is owed. And they would have to pay that if they were to choose to go directly to the district court. Now, if they chose to go through the administrative process, which is allowed for as well, the other option, they would go through the hearing, they would present their legal arguments, the basis for, in their particular instance, why the gas out there that the audit division is claiming is comparable gas, is not comparable. They could make all those arguments before the administrative agency. The final or the proposed decision made by the hearings examiner would be, of course, proposed to the commissioner, which he could choose to accept or to reject, or to accept in part. And there have been instances where he has rejected.
What if the lessees just choose not to pay?
If the lessee chooses not to pay, at the very beginning, Justice Heck,
yes.
Are you saying that, in other words, if the audit assessment billing is sent out and they just don't answer, they don't do anything?
That's right.
At that point, I believe that we would have the authority to issue a final order over at the General Land Office. Commissioner Marr would review the proposed findings and the proposed rulings by the hearings examiner, and if he chose to follow that, it would probably be sent over to the Attorney General's office for enforcement. Plus,
what does enforcement mean?
For collection.
What does that involve? A lawsuit?
That involves a lawsuit on...
De novo?
No, it would be based on a final order that the agency issues.
Where is that in the statutes?
It's not anywhere in the statutes, but the provision itself does state that it would be a final order in Section 52.137. It mentions that the lessee may appeal a final decision of the land office commissioner to the courts. And I would interpret that as meaning that it would be a final order.
Before this process was adopted, if the state wanted the money from the lessee, it had to sue him in court to get it.
That's not necessarily so. With regard to permanent school fund lands under Section 52.176 of the Texas Natural Resources Code, the agency had and the land commissioner had the authority to forfeit the lease. There's also another provision at 52.029.
If they wanted the money.
If they wanted the money.
They had to sue to get it.
If they wanted the money, they'd have to refer the case over to the Attorney General's office for prosecution.
And you say now that under this procedure, if you get an order from the land commissioner that lessee pay a certain amount of money, you can take that to court and basically there's no defense to it.
I would assume not, because they had the right, they had the chance to go before the agency or to take a direct appeal to the district court, and they chose not to do it. What would that cause? I mean, no one would ever respond to this. It would be a nullity. There'd be no reason for setting up this type of scheme.
Well, you argue in your brief that the only reason for it actually is to give them more rights than they had before. Give them a chance to persuade the commissioner before he decides.
That's exactly right.
Well, but now you're saying there's another reason, and the other reason is so that we can go to court armed with an order of the GLO to which there is no defense.
Well, we would hope that the lessees would come before the administrative agency. We don't really want to be taking default judgments against our lessees in the administrative process.
Well, there are three choices. They can either stand silent and ignore the process and face inevitable order in court, or they can try to go persuade the land commissioner that he's wrong, or they can put up the amount of the deficiency and go to court. Are those quite the same options that they had before this procedure was adopted?
The only options that they had before was if the land commissioner forfeited the lease to take an application for writ of mandamus to this court. In fact, there was a 1935 decision, Justice Heck, that Senator Yarbrough was involved in back at that time, Magnolia Petroleum Company versus Walker, where the commissioner of the General Land Office, it was Walker at the time, Commissioner Walker, decided to forfeit a lease, and there was all sorts of confusion about the statutory authority that he had, whether this was a Relinquishment Act lease, whether the surface owner owned the minerals pursuant to a...
We held that was reviewable by mandamus, and I take it the commissioner could still forfeit a lease today under that, if he just decided to forfeit.
Our position would be that this here will prevent a forfeiture. If they go through this administrative process...
The commissioner still has the right, surely, under 52.176, to forfeit the lease if he chooses.
If he chooses, and if the lessee refuses to go through the administrative process or else doesn't pay the amount that's owed.
He can do it independently, if that.
I don't believe he can, just a sec. I believe that this statute here essentially gives the lessees additional rights that they didn't have before.
Do you have a provision that you can point to that says that because of the enactment of 52.135.137, the land commissioner can no longer forfeit a lease just because he decides in his discretion it's in the best interest of the state to do it?
There is no express provision to that effect, Justice Heck. It's purely an interpretation from reading this statute. You want to, of course, read the two statutes together and make them jive. You want them to make sense together. And it seems to me that if 52.135 requires, because it does use the word shall, if it requires the land commissioner, after determining that amounts are owed, to issue this deficiency assessment, and then if the lessee demands a redetermination hearing, hold a hearing, as is required by 52.135, I don't believe that he could, in the middle of the stream here, in the middle of this hearing, decide, well, my mind's already made up, and forfeit the lease.
Before this procedure, if a lessee didn't want to pay, he could just not pay, and then when the state sued him for the amount they claimed was due, he could defend the lawsuit. Now, that procedure has been substituted with one where if he doesn't pay, he either has no defense or he's got to pay the amount of the deficiency to a certain, is what it boils down to.
If he refuses to pay to go to the courthouse, that is true. But he is given the option to go to the courthouse to pay, just as the comptroller's office does, to pay before going to the courthouse or go through the administrative process. And after a hearing is concluded, if the audit assessment that's issued by the land office pursuant to the audit division's recommendations is changed, then of course that will be appealed at the time if there's any difference in the amount owing. If it's rejected, then there will be no appeal.
If you did not have this alternative of going to the courthouse, albeit at a price, would the General Land Office Commission hearing set up have problems under Ward versus City of Monroeville?
Justice Phillips, you're referring to the biased adjudicator issue that the Rutherford 1 Court addressed. We don't believe that he would have that problem. The Monroe decision or Monroeville decision really is distinguishable. In that line of cases, it's the Berry Hill and Gibson versus Gibson decision and the Monroeville decision. Those cases had to do with the person, the adjudicator, the judge, having a pecuniary interest. It may have been major in the case of the Berry Hill decision, where the mayor was actually receiving directly proceeds from the fines that he was issuing, or it could be in the situation of the Monroeville case, where the mayor, who's responsible for looking after the finances of the city, and incidentally, the finances of the city, its budget is based, I think the evidence that before the court was clear that it was based substantially on the fines and penalties that were being assessed by the mayor. So what you had was his responsibility to make sure that the city can continue to operate. Somewhere in the vicinity of 50-60% of the budget was based on these fines. In the case of the land office, you don't have the commissioner of the general land office having any interest whatsoever, any pecuniary interest whatsoever in the amounts that are assessed by the audit division. You don't even have any powers, he does not possess any powers to administrate the permanent school fund. That is totally administered by a different agency in the state of Texas. So we don't have the same kind of problems there that we might have had, or that the Supreme Court recognized in Monroeville. You don't have that direct involvement, even though it may have been somewhat minor, not as direct as in the Monroeville case as it was in the Berry Hill case, there was nevertheless this pecuniary interest in it that was involved. And I would, of course, my time's run out, but I would also mention that there are a number of other hearings processes that we refer to on application for the VAR, where other agencies...
Let's take those up on...
Counsel, I've got one comment before you sit down. I want you to think about it, and I hope the other side will address it when they get up. I cannot shake the feeling that the lessees find themselves in a catch-22 situation here. Either they have no defense, or they pay to go to court, or they're compelled to go through the agency's administrative process, and I can't shake the feeling that somehow or other this does violence to the due process right to an impartial adjudication by a non-party. Here the commissioner, as they point out in their briefs, does have fiduciary duty to maximize the state's take here. I also have some difficulty with the pay to go to court provision that requires them to put up the money or not have their day in court. And I wonder about the deprivation of property without due process and also the open courts provision of our Constitution. And I hope you'll address those when you get up again. The other side will start off with them.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May I please report, Mr. Pam Schenken will present argument before respondent.
May I please report, I'm Pete Schenken. I represent Rutherford and Conoco, and by special agreement today, Flag, Rutherford, and Ladd. Respondents in this cause. Justice Gamage, where you want me to start is exactly where I want to start. What this case is about is whether the General Land Office or anyone can be judge in its own cause. General Land Office, it is indisputable, is trustee for state lands with a fiduciary duty to maximize revenues from those lands. I say it's indisputable. The General Land Office took that position up through the Court of Appeals. They may now have changed it. But it is clearly the case. In that capacity as trustee, the General Land Office executed some of the leases in question. And in that capacity as trustee, the General Land Office made demands on all these respondents that they pay what the General Land Office claimed they owed in additional royalties under these leases. Now, the General Land Office says that it will also be the judge of whether its claims are
correct. Why is that true? Seems to me that all the land commissioner is saying is you can have a chance if you want it to talk me out of it before I do it. What's wrong with that?
Well, it's more than that. It's not just you have a chance to talk me out of it. It's if you, and if you don't talk me out of it, you have to pay before you can go to court. In my client, my particular client's case, it's nearly $5 million.
But doesn't that happen in other administrative agencies in this state? Doesn't the comptroller do exactly the same thing with people who pay other forms of taxation under protest? They're required to pay it up first before they can challenge his ruling at the courthouse?
Mr. Justice Mosley, as far as I know, there is no administrative agency proceeding in the state of Texas in which the administrator is a party to a lease and says, before you can sue in a neutral court to find out whether you are right, you the lessee are right about what the lease means, or whether I, the administrator, and lessor am right about the lease, what the lease means, you have to pay first.
So you're saying if we set up a different agency, if there was some other, if this scheme were under some other branch of the executive department, you'd have no case. It's the fact that it's under the general umbrella of the general land office.
We would have a much weaker case if it were truly independent of the lessor, and it's stronger than just the lessor in our particular case. The underlying dispute in Rutherford's case includes a major estoppel argument. You don't have to rule on the merits of whether the GLO is estopped here, but you need to know that the merits include a controversy. The General Land Office investigated the same leases and a bunch of others back in the early 80s on the same issues of what these royalty clauses meant, took briefs from all these parties, including one of my partners at my law firm, looked at all of that and said, you're right. Your lease interpretation is correct. You don't owe any royalties for the period 78 to 83.
Doesn't the comptroller...
And turned around 3 years later and said you do.
The IRS or any of these other agencies make a lot of regulations, which are then the subject of dispute in these administrative hearings? I mean, what's the real difference here, the fact that the General Land Office has signed a lease? It's all done pursuant to state law. This isn't state law. The legislature passed it.
The state law has put some limits on what the lessor can sign. The power, the underlying power to do the lease is a common law right. The state, as an owner of land, has a right to lease and had it before there were any statutes limiting exercise of that right.
Under the Internal Revenue Act...
You want to ask a question?
Excuse me, go ahead.
If I may, Mr. Justice, just finish the answer to that. It seems to me, though, that it is more fundamentally different to say, I'm signing a lease with you. It includes the critical clause, the royalty clause. And then there arises an issue over what that clause means, and then you say to the lessee, and I agree with you, that's all you owe. And then you go out and you produce your wells for 3 more years in reliance on that. And
well,
have been
that's just the
otherwise.
Rutherford case.
Yes, sir. Right.
Well, let's put on your Flag Redfern in here.
All right, Flag Redfern. Now, the argument in Flag Redfern is it's not good. The argument in Flag Redfern, as I understand it, and I'm not as familiar with the fact.
Well, take your other client. I'm sorry. The third client in this case. Take Conoco or Ladd.
Conoco and Rutherford are together. The Ladd issues,
right,
I believe.
Take Ladd.
I believe the Ladd issues are also royalty clause issues.
But there's no estoppel argument. I just want to get the estoppel argument out of this one.
I would not.
You said we didn't have to rule on
I would not represent that they don't have an estoppel contention. But it seems to me you do have to confront the issue. If there's a serious allegation that somebody's estopped because it's manifestly unjust for them to turn around 3 years later when you can't do anything about it, you can't unproduce the wealth, and they've gotten the benefit of the royalties during that time, should that entity be the one that's the judge of whether that estoppel exists?
Well, counsel, don't you have the right of trial de novo?
Yes, and...
Do you know of any other setup under the administrative law of this state where the aggrieved individual has the right of trial de novo when he appeals from any administrative agency ruling, whether it be the education department, the comptroller's office, or anything else? Don't they all have to appeal under substantial evidence?
Almost all of them do now, Your Honor, but that's simply not the issue. Ward v. Monroeville addresses that directly. There was trial de novo there, and the Supreme Court 7-2 said it does not matter, does not cure the due process violation. Petitioner is entitled to a neutral and detached judge in the first instance, and so are we.
But
and there is a good reason why that is the case, which goes back hundreds of
years. In this case,
the
commissioner is entitled to make up his mind whether
you owe more money or not.
And sue us if he finds we owe more money.
And he can make it up with you there or without you there.
That's right.
And if he chooses, if the legislature chooses to require him to decide with you there, how is that a violation of due process?
If he makes us pay first to go to court, it is...
He doesn't do that. The legislature did that.
If the statute makes you pay first before you go to court, you have clearly been prejudiced in a substantial way. There are
But doesn't
other ways
that
as well.
Mean that the real rub here is not the commissioner making up his own mind about what his lease means, which he, like you, is entitled to do, but that you now have to pay before you can get a judicial determination?
I contend there are three real rubs. That is one of them. One is that it is wrong. It is morally wrong, and it has been against the law in Anglo-American jurisprudence, as far back I've been able to trace it to 1625, for someone to be a partisan and be judge in the same case, even if there are no consequences.
How is he the judge in his own case? I need you to explain that to us.
Because his decision is final unless appealed. You can't appeal unless you pay. And under the very same statute, you have to, there's no express language addressing the burden of proof, but we know who the burden of proof would be on if he took his case to the Attorney General and the Attorney General sues. The burden would be on the plaintiff. There's nothing that guarantees that when I'm taking an appeal under the statute and limited to some grounds that have been set forth at the agency, that he'll still have to bear the burden of proof. So we haven't, obviously, there have been no cases on that yet.
Counsel, if the Internal Revenue Service makes an assessment and you decide not to proceed through the normal appellate level process and instead wish to go to the United States District Court, are you not required to pay the full amount of the assessment before you are entitled to file suit in the United States District Court for a refund?
I don't know, but it's not the same thing even if you are.
Isn't that the situation with the state comptroller? You can pay under protest and you can go to court. But don't we have a distinction here? In the case of the comptroller, you've got a collection agent for the state, if you will, someone who's determining under the statutes what you owe, under the tax formulas, what you owe, is charged with collecting them. They're not a party to the transaction. They're an enforcement agent. You can go to a neutral court. You've got to pay before you can go. But if they are not a beneficiary of the contract, there is no contract. They are enforcing a legislative provision. The insurance board, in the Saeed case, is adjudicating between third parties. They are not a party. Here, you have GLO that is a party to the contract, which ostensibly is mutually beneficial to both parties. That's the whole purpose in the contract, adjudicating the terms of the contract, forcing it. And then, if you object, either you go through that administrative process or you pay to go to court.
And you pay, yes, exactly, Your Honor, and you pay an amount that...
And if you don't do either one of those, you have no defense.
That's correct.
So
pay an amount that your opposing partisan decides.
How much leeway does the General Land Office have in making these lease terms that then later come under this adjudicatory scheme? I mean, I'm trying to understand it. If we go as broad as I hear perhaps some people saying, I don't see how you could ever have a regulatory board like the Board of Medical Examiners or Dental Examiners take away a license, because they're certainly a party to the agency is a party to the very issue that they're judging, which then we've held is only has to go up on substantial evidence review. And they certainly have a lot of discretion in making that judgment. I would think as much discretion in deciding whether or not to proceed with sanctions against one of their licensees, as much discretion as the land office would have in making up the terms of the lease agreement. Am I missing something?
Well, it may just be that we're seeing it from different perspectives, and my perspective is the one of the lawyer for the party who has been abused. As
well, I guess I just want to see what the implications of your argument are. How far did this go to raising constitutional questions with our whole administrative scheme? That's what I'm trying to understand.
And I don't think it goes to disrupting the function of the Board of Medical Examiners or the Comptroller for the reasons that Justice Kamen addressed, the Board of Medical Examiners is not in a position where they say, here we have this procedure where you have to come tell us first what your reasons are. We did that. We said, no, wait a minute. You already told us we didn't owe this, and then we went out and produced it. And they said back to us, that doesn't matter. Nothing we say can stop us. And we said, that can't possibly be right. And they said, well, if that's the way you feel about it, here's $1,000,009 of prejudgment interest that we're adding to our demand. I don't think there's anything analogous in the way the Board of Medical Examiners conducts its business. I certainly hope not. If there is, then perhaps it also falls under some cloud.
But for the estoppel issue, if we're just talking about a straight interpretation of the lease agreement, where's the difference?
By the lessor, who is also trying to be the judge. One position that's partisan, one judicial.
Don't these administrative agencies write their own standards and make their own regulations, which a breach of them can lead to suit?
They write their
regulations. I'm not asking you to say that every other agency is constitutional. I just want to know where you would draw the line.
Well, I think I would draw it there. I think your question's a fair one. What is the distinction between drawing up a regulation, presumably in some rulemaking proceeding or something, and then applying it in a specific case to the detriment of a licensee or some other regulated private party? And maybe it is an intuitive thing that it feels much stronger to be...
harder for us to write.
I can fairly accept that.
What is the beneficial interest a regulatory agency has? They're charged with measuring competence, overseeing the competence and regulation of a profession or a trade that requires licensing, and determining whether or not there are violations of the regulations in the scope of determining whether or not someone should remain licensed or should receive some type of sanction. Where is their beneficial interest? Here you have a contract. Here you have a lease, a lessor and a lessee. One goes out and does the drilling, the other one collects royalties for them having granted the lease, and yet they're charged with the, under this statute, apparently adjudicating their own contract. This is not true in any other cases. These regulatory agencies may be able to promulgate regulations, but it's the legislature that writes the basic contract.
Yes, I think that is the basis of the distinction.
If the General Land Office had its own treasury, I would see an easy distinction, but doesn't their money all go into the
Yes, but that's the direct pecuniary interest argument. That was advanced by the two dissenters in Ward versus Monroeville. It's rejected. The distinction is, but there explicitly, what the dissenter said was, hell, the mayor has no direct interest, no direct financial stake in the controversy. How can this be a violation of due process? The majority said that misses the point. The point is there's an institutional partisanship. That's the same here. The General Land Office is trustee with this duty to maximize these revenues.
Do you feel that you and your clients have more rights today since these amendments to the Natural Resources Code in 1986 than you had beforehand?
Certainly.
Fewer rights?
Well, if they are right, we have fewer rights. They are not right, I am confident, and therefore we have the same rights.
If the statute did not require you to pay under protest before going to court, would you challenge the audit procedure?
At first, I would, of course, ask my client. The things my clients would consider would be the two other issues, Mr. Justice Heck. One is, the way they started this in asking me to take on these cases, this just seems wrong to us. This can't be right in America that they can be judging their own fault. But the other factor, in addition to the pay to go to court, was it is unclear whether we really would have the same right on this kind of an appeal, even if it were not for paying such. Who would have the burden of proof? Would we be limited to the issue?
Whoever the plaintiff was. Well, either they'd be suing you for the deficiency or you'd be suing them for declaratory judgment, if you could. Maybe sovereign immunity bars that. But follow the normal procedures. If there were not a requirement that you pay it under protest, would this make any difference to anybody?
If there were no requirement that you pay under protest, and it were clear that I could go to court for my client with the burden being where it was before, no limitation on the issues being artificially placed by having to go
trial
to
de novo.
Then I believe the correct answer is my client would not pay me to bring the case to you. As an officer of the court, it still offends me.
That the land commissioner was making up his own mind after talking to you about what he should do.
I suppose you had to have been there, Judge. That
no, no, I'm sure he made up his own mind in spades, but and it doesn't surprise me that the two of you don't agree about it. But it seems to me he has the right to do that. One party to a lease has the right to decide how to construe it, even if it's unreasonable.
I certainly agree with that, and we have said from the beginning, Mr. Justice Mosley, that if they believe strongly in the justice of their cause, they should exercise their right to walk over to the Attorney General's office, have him cross these same streets of the Travis County District Court, and get a suit on file against my clients, and we'll meet them in the courthouse on the merits of this controversy. Anytime they're ready, we're ready.
So you don't think that those amendments in 86, including the commissioners waiving sovereign immunity in behalf of Beta Tech, gave you any additional rights?
No.
You said earlier there were three rubs, paying under protest, being a judge in your own case, and then you were interrupted before you said the third.
The third is these specific questions about the scope of this appeal proceeding, that whether it would in fact be the same but for paying first, as the kind of case we know the Attorney General would have to bring if he sues. The question of the burden of proof, and the provision in the statute that purports to limit my side to a statement that we've already given the General Land Office.
If there were no audit procedure here, if the legislature just passed a statute that said a lessee, in order to defend against or claim there is no deficiency as determined by the land commissioner, must pay the assessed deficiency under protest apart from any audit procedure. Just to go to court, you had to pay that money under protest. Would that be permissible for the legislature or not?
Impermissible for just a very strong version of the same case you have here. There would be no pretense on the General Land Office's part that it was anything other than partisan. There would be none of this pretense that what we were doing at the General Land Office was having a judicial process in which we were fairly weighing these arguments.
Do you have a claim under the open court section of the Texas Constitution?
We believe we do, Your Honor. We believe that the Gilliam versus Putnam case makes it clear that if there is no provision in the statute that exempts those who cannot pay, then it violates the open courts provision. We are not here arguing, and there is nothing in the record to suggest whether any of the particular respondents here could or could not pay. It's a straight on the face of the statute.
What's your common law cause of action here?
I believe the common law cause of action is on the interpretation of the royalty clause.
Could you sue prior to this procedure against the state for declaratory judgment as to the meaning of the lease?
We would get into a dispute about the sovereign immunity.
How many years did this deficiency cover?
It depends on the lease, but in the case of the farthest back of Rutherford's leases, it's back to 1974. I'm not sure what the dates are for Flat Redfern Lab.
12 years, roughly?
Yes.
To take advantage of Dillingham, if you do otherwise fall within open courts provision, do you have to establish or make a prima facie showing that your clients are indeed not able to pay this?
We think not, under the reading of the case, that it's a simple question of whether the statute makes a provision for
Conoco can claim that because the Widow Humber wasn't looked out after properly in this statute.
Yes, and let me say there's a very good reason for that rule, Mr. Justice Phillips, and that is that only the people who can pay those costs can pay lawyers to make those arguments. It may well be that there have been a number of oil and gas companies that could not pay the General Land Office's exorbitant demand and still proceed and therefore settled on some terms with the General Land Office, and that only those who could and felt strongly enough about it are here before you.
Any other questions?
One other. You say in your brief a state lessee had and should still have a common law right not to pay the GLO's demand unless and until the GLO sues and obtains a judgment that the lessee owes additional royalties. There's no authority cited for that statement. Is there additional authority for that statement?
Not that I know of, Your Honor. The proposition is that as a lessee, I don't have to pay what my lessor tells me I owe just because he tells me I owe it, and there's no authority that says I do. That's what I meant for the common law.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Before you sit down, let me just pump up. Do you agree in all respect to the CA opinion, or are you different in any respect for the CA opinion in this case?
I suppose, Your Honor, that had I written the Court of Appeals opinion, I would have made the point about the violation that the General Land Office's interpretation of its rights would create of what it means to be a judge more strongly. I mean, I think a judge is someone who is neutral. That's the first thing we know about a judge, and the General Land Office is not. And it is from that starting point, in my mind, that you then reach these statutory interpretation questions and say, is there some way we can avoid these serious constitutional issues? Now, I think that's broadly still the thrust of the Court of Appeals opinion, and it's not a substantial disagreement.
Anything else? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And Justice Gonzalez, I'm not sure whether I heard your question or not. What is the difference between this case and the TCPIA cases?
No, I was curious if counsel accepted the CA's opinion as written, or were there any aspects of a particular CA opinion in this case that he disagreed with?
Could the legislature simply enact the law that said before a lessee can challenge an assessment by the land office, he must pay the assessed deficiency under protest?
I simply don't have an answer to that question. I'm not going to try to venture
it's
to
a
say whether he could or couldn't.
It's a pretty important question in this case.
Excuse me?
It's a pretty important question in this case.
You're saying without even having... See, what happens here is you've got the audit division issuing a deficiency assessment. It's not the land office, I mean the commissioner of the land office himself.
Well, the lessee is not too hopeful that they're going to be able to talk the commissioner out of his assessment. So,
well,
apart from all of that, could the legislature just say, you got to put the money up before you can go to court?
Well, that's essentially what it's done here.
That's essentially what
essentially
it's done.
What it's done here.
So can they do it or not?
I suppose the answer would be yes. I know that's what it's clearly done in the comptroller's office. And one of the things that perhaps may be somewhat difficult for Mr. Shenkin to accept is that maybe where we are now is exactly where the comptroller's office was a few years ago, quite a few years ago, when it started holding its administrative proceedings. Prior to that time, the state had to go to court to collect on taxes. This set up a new system. There's been a number of cases which have recognized that that's valid.
Is there any limitation on the comptroller's right to go back in years in terms of back taxes?
Are you referring to essentially a statute of limitations?
Yes.
You raise a very good point there, Justice Corner, that I think that a lot of people have really not recognized. And that's one of the things that 52-137 does, and maybe 52-138 or 139. It essentially says that the issues that are brought before the agency will be settled for all time. And what that solves is the problem that Mr. Shenkin is arguing about, which I disagree totally with him on, and I try to avoid getting into the merits.
But there's
no
estoppel issue. I'm sorry. Are you saying there is a limitation? No limitation?
There is a limitation. Once those issues are addressed...
What is that limitation in years for the comptroller under the analogous circumstances you suggest here? For the General Land Office, it appears to me there is no limitation.
I guess I jumped the gun on that because I wanted to bring that before the court to point out how you wouldn't have these estoppel problems once these audit proceedings went through. But there
my question
is not
relate to estoppel.
There is not a similar statute of limitations with regard to the agency.
So you could go back to 1963 under this lease and make assessments for deficiencies in royalty.
I suppose we could.
And thus, there is no limitation on the amount of money the GLO could require the lessee to pay in order to file a lawsuit to contest the assessment.
Well, the limitations will be based on the audit division's interpretation of that lease provision and what they feel is owed. I mean,
so it could be a few dollars. It could be $5 million, roughly, as in here, or it could be. There's no limitation on the amount of money that the lessee could be required to pay to go to court.
It could be $2,000, it could be $1,500, it could be $5 million.
And why does that violate the open courts provision?
Why does it not?
Constitution? Right, that interpretation.
The reason it doesn't violate the open courts provision is for a couple of reasons. This court, in two recent decisions, Rose versus Doctors Hospital, 801 Southwest 2nd, 841, 1990 decision, and Moreno versus Sterling Drug, 787 Southwest 2nd, 348, a March 1990 decision, stated that a litigant must satisfy two criteria in order to go to argue that there's an open court violation. One, he must have a cognizable common law cause of action. I've already argued that Rutherford and the rest of the respondents don't have a common law cause of action against the state. I disagree with Mr. Shenton. They don't have a right to go to the courthouse. This is all set up pursuant to a statutory scheme, just like it was in Blount, just like it was in Saida, just like it was in Grounds. And that is something that we need to focus on. We've got three issues here. We've got a separation of powers issue, which I think is clearly resolved by those decisions. We have a biased adjudicator issue, and we have the open courts provision argument. In addition to those two cases, there are additional arguments that we've made.
Well, you say there's no common law right. There's a statutory right to go to the courthouse, right?
There is a statutory right to go to the courthouse now.
That would be illusory if there was such an impediment to going to the courthouse that this litigant or some other litigant could not avail themselves of that statutory right.
It'd be usury?
Illusory.
Oh, illusory. They just can't do it. They cannot go without having to pay this money. Now, one of the things that I think we need to look at also is that no one is looking at the fact that the state of Texas is contending that these proceeds belong to the state. There are arguments of estoppel. There's clear authority that I've cited in the brief. The Texas Company decision, the Humble Oil and Gas Company versus State decision, the Austin Court of Appeals decision in Capital Rod and Gun Club would specifically state that when the state is dealing with its lands, it is not to be stopped. It cannot waive anything. It cannot be subject to limitations. We have that here. It's something that had totally escaped the Court of Appeals in its opinion, that what we have here is a sovereign function. We don't have two private parties dealing with each other.
Any other questions? Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument for the morning. The court will stand in recess until 2 p.m.
The audience is advised.